the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income.
And I'm John Loeffler, and you know that the largest generation in U.S. history is beginning to pull retirement money this year. What does that mean? We're going to look at the next 20 years as being high-risk years for boomers. Here's what the deal is. U.S. law requires mandatory distributions from IRAs and 401ks when people reach 70 and a half years of age. The oldest of this nation's largest generation, the boomers, crossed that threshold barrier for the first time this month, this year. There are $10 trillion in retirement assets, and in the next decade, 60 million boomers age 70 and a half will have to draw from those IRA and 401k accounts. Now, here's the question. Why is this significant, especially if you're a boomer, and perhaps for everybody else? So why don't you lay the background to this, Jim?
Well, let's kind of put this into perspective, because boomers are entering retirement, John, at a period of the lowest returns that we are likely to see. And we'll get into some studies here shortly that substantiate what I'm saying here. But the lowest returns for both stocks and bonds going forward. And why that is really important, because if you take a look at life expectancies today, they've gone up something like 2 years or 1 year every decade. So the average life expectancy today is between 19 and 22 years. So if you're age 65 right now, your life expectancy is between 19, 21 and a half years. 21 and a half is probably more with the women. So life expectancy has increased, whether we're seeing more and more people live out their years into their 80s, in their 90s. You know, in our own family's case, my grandparents passed away in their 70s. And, you know, here my mom is turning 86 this month. And so, you know, this life extension due to medical, due to health, due to diets, all the kind of things that we have at our fingertips today. And it's going to be amazing, because I'm just reading a book, John, by Steve Case. It's called The Third Wave, and it's talking about the Internet 3.0. And I'm sure a lot of you that run for sports, or maybe you have an Apple Watch or a Fitbit, all these devices that we have today that monitor our heartbeat, the amount of steps, the calories we burn. John, in the next 10 years, we're going to see devices that we will wear that will monitor our vital organs in our body, from our heart to our liver to all the major elements, to our brain. It will record it. It will send it to your doctor. So we're doing things that this advancement in medical technology, whether it's drug therapy, treatment therapy, monitoring, prevention, diet, exercise, all the things that we are advancing as a result of technology and advancements in knowledge, are extending that life. So you are more likely, I mean, right now, the life expectancy is between 20 and maybe 22 years. Midway during your retirement, or maybe towards the end of your retirement, that 19 to 22 years may be extended to 25 to 30 years. So it's really important that you really begin to think about this, because if you are entering into retirement or approaching age 65, understand you are going to begin your retirement at a time where you can expect the lowest rate of return on investment assets in your lifetime.
Well, this is one thing, of course, we've discussed at length, both on the weekend show and here on Lifetime Income. You look at what has happened to interest rates since the crisis between 2007, 2009. We have had the lowest interest rates in recorded history. Now, that's changing, but that means this has been a horrible time to earn interest.
Well, it's not just that, because typically when somebody retires, they reach age 65, they're no longer working, their portfolios tend to get more conservative. So you're seeing asset allocation that will change from maybe less risky, less stocks, more fixed income, things like treasuries, bonds, CDs, annuities, things that are very predictable. Well, retirees have seen, and those that are retiring are entering into an era that we have seen the lowest interest rates. I mean, if you retired in the last 4 or 5 years, what have you seen? You've seen the dividend distributions from bond funds, mutual funds, from bond ETFs consistently fall each year, reducing your income. And I can't emphasize this too many times. You are looking at something that we have never seen in recorded human history. Boomers are retiring and living through something, quite honestly, it's never been in the history books. There was a study that was done and published about interest rates, and it was provided by somebody at Merrill Lynch, an investment strategist called Michael Hartnett, and he did a piece, and they traced back interest rates, and somebody said, could they really do that? Believe it or not, folks, we have recorded tablets from the time of Hammurabi that records interest rates, which were codified in the Hammurabi laws. But most boomers in their working career entered their working career in their peak earning years in a period of high interest rates. For example, in the early 80s, in 1981, 10-year treasuries got up to 15.84%. I remember that very clearly. One of the first clients I had here in California when I started my practice, she wanted something very, very safe, something predictable, and I put her in a 10-year treasury note at 15%. Imagine getting that back then. Now, we have had periods of times in the past, just like we did under Reagan, where interest rates were higher. For example, they were 20% in Mesopotamia. They were 40% when King Cyrus conquered Babylon. They were higher during periods of inflationary times and epochs, for example, towards the decline of the Roman Empire, when the emperors were depreciating the currency. They were 15% under Diocletian. During the Italian Dark Ages, they got as high as 20%. But if you take a look at recorded history throughout 5,000 years, interest rates have averaged between 6 and 10%. I know through most of my working career, at least until we got to the bursting of the tech bubble, it was very easy to get 6, 7, 8%. Now, think about this for a moment. In 1990, if you had $100,000, I could have got you $10,000 a year in interest. And I could have done that with safe things. I could have done it with not quite munis. I could have got maybe 7 or 8% on munis, but I could have got 10% easily in 1990 on treasuries, zero coupon treasuries, treasury notes. I could have got even more, 11, 12% on Ginnie Mae. So you could have got $12,000 of interest. Fast forward 10 years. In the year 2000, $100,000 would produce $8,000 of income. Now, fast forward to this week in 2017, $100,000 would only produce 2.3% or $2,300. That is a 10-year treasury note. If you were in things that people traditionally invested in, short-term certificates, a deposit, maybe 1 year, 6 months, 2 years, or two-year treasury bills, it's actually a little over $1,000. I mean, a two-year treasury note today wouldn't even produce $1,100 interest on $100,000. So that just goes to show you how low we have gotten. I have never seen anything like this in my entire investment career have I seen, because I got in this industry at the time we were hitting those Reagan peaks when treasuries got up almost to 16%.
But I would think, Jim, that the other issue isn't just the low rates where you don't make any money, but if the interest rates start to rise like they did in 2013 or toward the end of last year, you can lose money on bonds.
Oh, absolutely. It's not just the fact that you're looking at the lowest interest rates in 5,000 years. So when you get to rates that are that low, and gosh, I'm trying to think if we could put this graph up. It shows interest rates going back to 3000 BC to where they are today. It is a remarkable graph. There has only been one major spike since Hammurabi's time. Well, I take that back. Cyrus, when he conquered Babylon. But the only other spike that even came close was under Reagan in 1981. But throughout human history, almost 5,000 years, interest rates were fairly consistent between 5 to 10%. You can see this over an extended time frame. So it's not just that you're looking at this. So when you're at the lowest level, what happens when interest rates start to rise? And they're exactly what you just said, John. If you own, let's say, for sake of argument, you're an institution, you bought a 10-year Treasury note in June of last year when Treasuries got down to 1.3%, think of the losses that you had when interest rates got up to 2.6% 6 months later. And here's the unfortunate thing for boomers heading into retirement. You can lose a lot of money in bond bear markets. And the difference between bond bear markets, when we think of stock bear markets, we think of 1 to 2 years. Think of 2007 to 2009, or let's say 2000 to 2002. The thing about bond bear markets, they're not 1 to 2 years. They're 2 to 3 or more in decades. Bonds peaked just shortly after World War II, and then we saw a period of rising interest rates that began in the 50s all the way up till 1981. So it was a 3-decade-long bear market. The point being here, boomers are going to live out their entire retirement years through a major bond bear market. So if you're retiring today at age 65, your life expectancy 20 years, those 20 years, you are going to experience a bond bear market. And bond bear markets, unlike the stock market, are long and continuous, and you can lose, contrary to opinion, a lot of money. When I got in the business, John, in 1979, 1980, when we talked about bonds, we used to call them certificates of confiscation because inflation was eroding the value and purchasing power of those bonds. I mean, you know, you can take a bond today, and even though we've been in this low inflationary environment, go back to the year 2000. Think of anything that you own today that you want to purchase. Yes, I can buy a TV set cheaper. I can get a DVD player cheaper. But think of what you paid for food in the year 2000 and compared for what you're paying for food today. Think of your medical premiums today, now that you're older, but compare that to what you paid for your medical premiums, let's say 17 years ago. Think of what it costs to buy a car today, what it costs to buy a home today, what it costs to travel today, what your utility bills are, what your insurance premiums on your car, on your home, all the basic necessities of life. Think what you're paying today compared to what you paid, let's say, in the year 2000. So you can lose a lot of money in a bond bear market.
Well, I know when we've talked about this in times past, you've always done that example that during the taper tantrum, remember when rates doubled, people in bond funds lost a lot of money, and things had been okay in 2013, 2014. But starting now and going forward, it's probably not going to be okay regarding bonds.
No, a good example, you know, we always use these to typify what you see in the bond market, and there are two popular ETFs, probably the most popular. TLT is 20-year treasuries, and LQD is corporate bonds. In 2013, TLT lost 13.4%. In 2016, last year, TLT was only up 1.2%. LQD in 2013 lost 2%. Corporate bonds have done a little bit better. They pay more. In 2016, corporate bonds were up a little over 6%. What is remarkable is if you were to go back last year when treasuries got down to 1.3%, when we had that big drop in interest rates following Brexit with an injection of liquidity by the Bank of England, bond funds like TLT and LQD, John, were up over 20%. I mean, they were killing the stock market. I mean, if you take a look at the first 6 months of the year, the best place to be was in bonds. It wasn't in stocks, even though stocks, you know, were going up during the first 6 months of the year. But if you were in bonds, you were making double digits as interest rates began the year at roughly about 2.3% and got down to 1.3% by summer only to end up at nearly 2.6%. In other words, giving back the majority of those gains. And it reminds me of something that really struck home with me. When I got in the business, I was getting in the business towards the tail end of the bear market that had lasted three decades. It began in the 50s. It ended in August of 1981 when you saw treasuries hit almost close to 16%. It was 15.84. And I'll never forget one client that we had at the firm. He was a retired corporate executive, retired back in 1968. He had a home that was free and clear. He had a pension from the company. He had Social Security, and he had close to a little over $1 million in assets. $750,000 he had put into a bond portfolio. He had a mixture of corporates, treasuries, and municipal bonds to keep his tax bracket down. When we saw him in 1981, that $750,000, remember, mutual funds weren't as prolific as they are today, and ETFs didn't even exist. You might have had unit trust. But back in 68, if you were a wealthy individual, you wanted bonds, you went out. I think there was only one or two bond mutual funds. I can remember a time when all the mutual funds together made up less than a quarter of a page of the Wall Street Journal. So he had an individual bond portfolio, which meant, you know, these were bonds that were 20 and 30 years in terms of maturity. And those interest rates back when he was buying them were anywhere from 2.5% to 4%, depending on his munis. And I can remember in 1981, that $750,000 bond portfolio had a market value of $400,000. In other words, he had lost $350,000 in market value from 1968, the year he bought them, to 1981. And don't forget, in 1981, inflation was running at 14%. And at that time, treasuries were at over 15%, 15 to 18, almost 16%. And you could get 9 and 10% in tax-free bonds versus, you know, the 2.5% he was getting back in 1968. So in many ways, it reduced his lifestyle. What saved him was his Social Security, because they began to really index Social Security. So obviously, you know, the inflation rates, they weren't dickering with the inflation CPI like they've done over the last two or three decades. So when inflation was running 14%, he was getting a 14% increase in his Social Security. And then the other thing that helped him out was his stock portfolio of blue chip stocks and utilities, which had raised their dividends. Now, the reason I'm mentioning all this is a lot of financial plans, financial planning software, pension plans have unrealistic assumptions built into not only planning software, forecasting software, and assumptions that pension funds that are using for their retirees, especially defined benefit pension plans, including my own state of California, which has had to ratchet down its returns to, I think, 7.25%. And believe it or not, 7.25% is still unrealistic. So, you know, one of the things that we do is we have financial planning software just like everybody else, but we do not. We go in and adjust the rate of return assumptions, because we just don't buy into those long-term, you know, you're going to make 10% in stocks, you're going to make 6-7% in bonds. We just don't buy into it. We haven't seen it in the last 17 years. And folks, remember, in the year 2000, when the S&P peaked in March of the year 2000, it would not exceed its peak reached in March until April of the year 2013. So if you were indexing passive investing in an S&P 500 fund between 2000 and 2013, your rate of return was just slightly under 2%. And that mainly came from dividends. You had zero price appreciation from the year 2000 to 2013. Any return you got in an S&P index fund strictly came from the dividends that you had.
You have often talked about the concept of unrealistic expectations on returns. There's actually some studies out there that would seem to corroborate a lot of what you've been saying. And this is under increasing conversation given what we've seen in the stock market. All stock market's done pretty well, but things that we have seen over the last 8 years.
Yeah, there were two articles that recently came out in Barron's. One was titled, The Next 10 Years, Ugly for Your 401k. So this not only applies to boomers, it applies for a lot of you Gen Xers and millennials who are still in the workforce, or boomers who are still in the workforce. So basically, and then the other article was, Forget 30 Years of Stock and Bond Divergence. Everything is changing. Now, the first article, The Next 10 Years Will Be Ugly for Your 401k, was an advisory firm, Research Affiliates. And what they did is they took a look at 11 retirement calculations commonly used in retirement planning software. They took a look at robo-advisors. They took a look at surveys of institutional investors. You know, what do you expect to be the returns on invested assets? Their average long-term expected return is 6.2%. However, if you subtract their expected inflation rate of 1.6%, which we're already running above that now, your rate of return is 4.6%. There's two things that stand out. The rate of return is too high and the inflation is too low. And what they went on to say is, all right, let's be conservative. Most people say, well, maybe we'll just go for a 5% rate of return. That seems reasonable and conservative. Folks, it isn't. Looking at asset allocation models, the typical asset allocation model when you head into retirement, 60% stocks, 40% bonds, or 60% bonds, 40% stocks. It's one of those two percentages that are used. If you invested in a balanced mutual fund or a balanced ETF, chances are you're looking at that 60-40 split. Now, brace yourself. You might want to go get some Maalox when I tell you this. According to the report, the ubiquitous 60-40 portfolio, and I'm going to pause when I tell you this, has a 0% probability of achieving a 5% return or greater in the next 10 years. Let me repeat that. A 60-40 split between stocks and bonds has a 0% chance of producing a return of 5% or greater. There are several messages that came out of this report. One of them is the high returns in the past come at a cost. Anytime you see a high period of return, just think of the 1990s or the last 5 years of the 1990s with the internet and technology boom, when the stock market was up double digits every single year. What happened in the subsequent years following, as I just mentioned, from the year 2000 to 2013, the stock market went nowhere. So high returns come at a cost, and the cost is lower returns in the future. And what they said is a lot of these plans that are based on 6 and 7% returns, the reality, folks, is the return is likely to be between 2 and 3%. That is a massive, massive shortfall if you're planning for retirement or entering into retirement.
You know, if we look at the implication of what you're saying here, and this goes along with some case studies, what this means is with the lower rates of return, there are two possibilities here, all things being equal. Number one, you're going to work longer, or number two, have a lower standard of living during retirement.
Oh, exactly. And there's two reasons for this. Number one, we're starting from the lowest interest rates in 5,000 years of history. So there's one factor. Number two, we're also starting with a stock market that has a much higher PE ratio, meaning that you're having to pay as an investor more money to buy a dollar's worth of earnings. And when you go through these periods where the Cape-Shiller PE is at historical records, it implies lower returns going forward. Now, what they did is they said, well, what if we change this 60-40 split and we'll move it in a number of directions? We'll say instead of 60-40, we'll go 50-50. That rate of return wasn't much better. 2.3, if you add a little bit of commodities, add some emerging market bonds, it goes to 2.7. And then finally, if you take large cap stocks, commodities, high yield bonds, the return gets 2.9%. The point being is the likelihood of the rate of return over the next decade is going to be 3%. There was another report issued by the brokerage firm Sanford Bernstein, And they said, in the next decade, you're likely to see, number one, greater divergence between stocks and bonds. Number two, rising inflation. This goes back to the assumption on those returns, what they thought inflation would be only 1.6. It's more likely to be higher. Number three, greater shocks and volatility. Just think of the things we experienced in the last 16 years. So the Bernstein report issued that the 60-40 split is more likely to be a very risky allocation over the next 10 years.
As we've been talking, I'm trying to put this all together. And so an overall summary of what this really means, the implications, we need to do that.
Well, number one, if you're young enough, if you're a millennial, you're a Gen Xer, it means you're going to have to put away more money. You're going to have to save more. You're going to have to spend less. Number two, if you are heading into retirement or close to retirement, you're probably going to end up working longer or working part-time. And number three, you're going to have to lower your standard of living. If you don't have the funds, you don't have a pension, you're not fortunate to have a defined benefit pension plan, and don't forget, we're entering a period where eventually, especially in the next decade, government benefits from Social Security to Medicare are likely to be reduced. And one of the reasons I think you're going to see these diminishing returns over the next couple of decades, number one, inflation is more likely to rise than fall as the economy recovers. GDP growth without big productivity gains and larger economic growth could be weaker, and employment growth remains stagnant. Interest rates going from 5,000 years at the lowest point are more likely to head higher, and corporate profits are likely to be squeezed by rising inflation cost. Emerging market, new tech companies could cut into corporate profit margins. There are a number of reasons why, John, as these two studies talked about, is high returns of one era guarantee almost that you're more likely to experience lower returns in the next era. And that's where we find ourselves today. So heads up, if you are just starting out working, start early. Start putting away money. It's easier to do when you're younger and it takes less money. So if you're midway through your career, start saving more because you're going to need it. And number three, plan on retiring a lot later.
And I'd like to remind everybody that coming up tomorrow on the program, Dr. David Katz is going to be with us. He's going to be talking about a study that came out in U.S. News and World Report, the most effective diet for health and weight loss. It's called the DASH diet. That's tomorrow here on Lifetime Income. Now time for our life study. This is a real study based on real people. We change their names to protect their privacy, and they illustrate the principles that Jim and I have been talking about, and we have slides on the website that are available so you can follow the conversation.
All right. This week's case study in our crosshairs, Bill and Marcia White. A little background information. Bill is age 57. Marcia is age 58. Both want to retire soon. Life expectancy will be 90 years for Bill, and for his wife, 95. Their risk tolerance is moderate. Investment objective, like most people approaching retirement, income with preserving purchasing power. Bill is a regional manager. He has to travel often for work, which has made it very difficult for him to manage their finances. He manages most of their investments based on the advice from professionals he follows. He's accumulated large positions in precious metals, cash, and some stock holdings in blue chip companies. His current tax situation now and in retirement are a concern. He's hoping to change careers or retire in the next 5 to 10 years so he can travel less and spend more time with family and travel. Traveling this time not for business, but more for retirement. His wife, Marcia, her job, she works in human resources. She's hoping to be more focused on saving for retirement now that their youngest just finished college. She's more risk adverse than Bill and is concerned about their current investment strategy. Another concern of hers is their ability to retire since they will only have Social Security as an income source. She's also hoping to have her husband retire soon so she can spend more time with him and their family. So what's important to Bill and Marcia? Well, retiring in 5 to 10 years, that's the goal. Their level of income in retirement, managing investment risk, which is important for anybody when you consider retiring, when you're living off maybe Social Security in your investments, lower taxes. We take a look at their budget right now. They live fairly modestly. Essential budget is $43,000. Discretionary of $29,000. So total expenditures is $72,000. Bill's salary, $85,000. Marsha's salary, $42,000. They had surplus roughly of about $55,000 a year. In retirement, they see their essential budgets going up just slightly to $44,500. Discretionary would be cut to $15,000. So roughly about $60,000 a year. That's a reduction of about $12,000 a year, about $1,000 a month. Their income, $37,000 from Social Security. Shortfall without investments, $22,500. Looking at their balance sheet, their primary residence was $330,000, of which they owed about $75,000 left on the mortgage. Bill's retirement assets, $385,000. Marsha's retirement assets, $44,000. Their joint checking account and savings were about $110,000. And they had roughly about $200,000 in precious metals. A lot of that had to do with the financial crisis and the run-up in gold. Unfortunately, they put a little bit too much money in that sector and then got hit and whacked with the gold bear market that lasted almost 4 years. So total investment assets, $739,000, net worth just slightly under $1 million. One of the problems that we tried to stress with them is improper diversification, the tax efficiency of their investments. They wanted to minimize the impact of taxes. That was going to have to change. And in terms of how they were set up in managing income sources in retirement. What we did is we did equivalent of a balanced fund with one exception. We don't use bond funds and we don't use bond ETFs. We use individual bonds for the very reason that we discussed in today's show. If I own a 1 year bond, a 2 year bond, or a 3 year bond, I'm not worried about interest rates going up. If I own a 1 year bond, as we do in many of our portfolios, in 1 year, the bond comes due. If interest rates are higher, we can invest that money at a higher rate of interest. Same with the 2 year bond and 3 year bond. So we put the bulk of their assets in what we call a balanced account, which was between short-term fixed bonds. When I say short-term, usually 1 to 3 years, maybe four, and the rest in high-quality blue-chip paying stocks. The income would be 3.1%. The grand total, their investment income would be roughly about $17,000. The grand total would be almost $68,000 a year, less budget of about $60,000. So they would have a surplus a little over $8,000. And I said, you're going to have to save quite a bit of that. And the dividend payers, the idea was, we think interest rates are more likely to go up over the next 10 years. So what we explained to them is, if you have a short-term bond that matures in 1 year or 2 years, if interest rates are up, let's say 1 year from now, which I think they will be, just take a look at where they've gone from the summer of last year. As that bond comes due, you get your money back. You don't have to worry about a loss. You invested at a higher interest rate. The other thing, too, is if you own blue chip dividend paying stocks that have a long history, 25 years or more of increasing their dividend, there's a likely probability you're going to be seeing increased dividends. So that's going to help to take care of the inflation. So one of the things that we did is, through proper diversification, we reduced their holdings in precious metals to about a 6% allocation of their total net worth. We recommended they use the portion of cash for their rental home purchase as well. We replaced commodities, which are taxed at 28%, with blue chip stocks that are more taxed at a favorable rate, in their case, 15%. We also utilized corporate bonds in place of retirement accounts to reduce income taxes. Both Bill and Marsha would increase their retirement savings, purchase a home that they can rent out now, and then move into it at retirement to downsize, meaning they would be getting rid of their other house. They were going to buy a smaller house, and they were going to use it as a rental to take care of the cost. So basically, their monthly expenses wouldn't go up. The rental property would provide more tax write-offs and income for retirement. And the investment objectives were going to be focused more on income, producing investments like dividend-paying stocks and bonds. And the rental property would serve as additional source of income. and also eventually that would become their home. So, John, here was a case of proper diversification, a little tax planning, and a little difference of altering their portfolio and getting more in tune with where they're likely to be invested when they retire, in changing the portfolio mix around to reflect what their goals and objectives were.
And reminder again, Dr. David Katz is going to be our guest tomorrow, talking about the most effective diet for health and weight loss, the DASH diet. I was reading an article by a doctor recently, Jim, who had said, you know, it's time we doctors stop telling our patients they need to lose weight if we can't tell them how to lose weight. It was interesting that doctors realized that their patients were struggling with effective diets.
Yeah, what really surprised me when I looked at this study that came out with 38 diets, just about every popular diet from paleo, vegetarian, vegan, Nutrisystem, Jenny Craig, Mediterranean diet, South Beach diet. They looked at all of them, and they looked at them through a lens of not only losing weight, but also keeping you healthy. What does it do to your body for health reasons, for, let's say, cholesterol, for high blood pressure, in addition to losing weight? And I was really surprised at some of the diets that I had tried, that actually had worked with me effectively, was not necessarily the most effective. So you could really want to listen to this interview. I find it fascinating because I had never heard of the DASH diet before, and I ordered the book from some of the authors, and I'm reading it now, because it deals with issues like heart disease, high blood pressure, issues that we tend to fall into or suffer from as we age. So you really want to listen to this, because it was done by a group of doctors. There's no axe to grind. They weren't getting paid for by any particular group to push one diet over the other. It was just simple research. Does it make you healthy? How healthy? And is it effective in losing weight? That's coming up tomorrow. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries, or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.